from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! In an extraordinary decision, the World Bank and IMF announced they will scale back their upcoming meetings in Washington, D.C. to just 2 days for fear of mass protests. Activists say they'll sue if police keep them from the meetings. The fallout from state violence in Genoa continues as another protester is found dead. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi says upcoming international summit should take place in Africa. As the world focuses on the controversy surrounding the UN conference against racism, we'll look at a much less publicized but potentially more important UN meeting on racism in the United States. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With three justices taking the rare step of disqualifying themselves because of their ties to a murder victim's son, an evenly divided Supreme Court yesterday turned down a request for a stay of execution from a Texas prisoner scheduled to be put to death tomorrow. The justices, Antonin Scalia, David Souter, and Clarence Thomas, all have professional relationships with J. Michael Luttig, a prominent federal appeals court judge whose father was murdered in a botched carjacking in Texas in 1994. Because a majority is needed for a stay of execution, the court's 3-3 decision was a defeat for the death row prisoner Napoleon Beasley. A vote of a majority of justices is required for a stay of execution, which would be 5 in normal cases and 4 in this case, with only 6 justices sitting. Yesterday, the head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and a veteran death penalty lawyer, George Kendall, said a tie shouldn't go to the executioner. In New Orleans, a prisoner on death row in Texas since 1984 deserves a new trial because his lawyer slept during parts of his murder trial. Yesterday's opinion said the lawyer for the prisoner, Calvin Burdine, dozed off enough and long enough to deprive the defendant of his right to legal representation. Burdine was convicted of stabbing his lover, W.T. Wise, to death in 1983. Burdine confessed to the police but now denies killing Wise. Burdine came within moments of execution in 1987 before a court granted a reprieve. Militant farmer José Bové and 2,000 supporters returned this past weekend to the same McDonald's restaurant he helped dismantle 2 years ago, this time holding a more restrained rally to protest unchecked globalization and demand support for farmers. About 70 police officers in southern France cordoned off the parking lot to prevent the protesters, many wearing shirts that read "The world is not merchandise," from approaching the McDonald's. Large signs that read "Closed due to threats" were hung on the restaurant's windows. Bové and his allies pledged to continue their protests as long as necessary to gain support from the French government for farmers hit by a U.S. surcharge against Roquefort cheese, which is made in a nearby village. The protesters have targeted McDonald's as a symbol of how unchecked globalization can trample local culture. They lifted their siege of the McDonald's this morning. The Irish Republican Army dealt a major blow to the Northern Ireland peace process today when it announced it's abandoning a disarmament plan that had fueled hopes of progress in the volatile province. The IRA, in a statement, cited the rejection of its olive branch on disarmament by the province's pro-British unionists and accused Britain of failing to fulfill its obligations in the peace process. The arrest in Colombia of 3 Irishmen suspected to be Republican militants, thought by authorities to have been involved in training a left-wing guerrilla group in bomb-making and other techniques, has fanned unionist skepticism about the IRA's avowed commitment to peace. Britain suspended home rule and government for 24 hours last weekend, using a legal loophole to buy more time for talks on saving the Good Friday Accord. But Sinn Féin reacted with fury, accusing Britain of pandering to unionists who say they will no longer share power with Sinn Féin and the government while the IRA holds arms. This news from Jenin in the West Bank. Israeli tanks and bulldozers thrust into the West Bank town of Jenin today in what they say was a retaliatory strike following 2 recent Palestinian suicide bombings. The overnight raid was the deepest military incursion into Palestinian territory since an uprising against Israeli occupation flared last September after peace talks stalled. Palestinian gunmen put up fierce resistance as the tank-led armored force, helicopter gunships overhead, rumbled through the darkened streets to the governor's office in and raised a nearby police building. The force withdrew about 3 hours. The Palestinian Authority branded the operation a declaration of war and said it appealed to the United Nations Security Council for international protection.
In the search for cash, everybody wanna be some fat tycoon. Everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slave and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay? No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine, pass the buck, or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Say, ooh. Of our time. I say it one more time to emphasize the meaning of my rhyme.
Rock the Nation by Michael Franti and Spearhead from his CD Stay Human. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Organizers of protests at next month's annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank yesterday accused the two financial bodies of demonizing the movement against corporate globalization by citing fear of violent protests and deciding to cut back their joint gathering in Washington from 1 week to 2 days. The activists described as a partial victory the extraordinary weekend decision by two of the most frequent targets of protester pressure, saying it proved that the ranks of those opposed to the brand of economic globalization advocated by the IMF, the World Bank, and other multinational agencies and corporations were growing and their calls for change being noted. But they stressed that, scaled back or not, the meetings, now set for September 29th and 30th, rather than stretching into early October as initially planned, would still take place in the same closed-door fashion and in pursuit of the same policies on loans and aid to poor countries. The activists also said they were concerned over a request by the Washington Metropolitan Police for millions of dollars in federal aid to pay for riot gear, including some $1,800 in flame retardant suits for some officers, and to hire officers on temporary duty from police departments as far away as New York City. They also threatened legal action if police kept protesters far from meeting sites. We're joined on the phone now by Jokey Jehu, who is the director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jokey.
Thank you, Amy. I'm glad to be here.
Well, how did you manage to pull off this one, get the bank and IMF to abbreviate their meetings?
Well, I think they did that all on their own. We have maintained for years that these institutions are not open to public scrutiny, and I think that we believe that in terms of reducing the number of meeting days is that they think that there will be less public scrutiny. We are continuing to plan. Nothing has changed because, of course, the point of all of this is not the meetings. The point is the policies and practices of these institutions. If they had announced that the debts were being cancelled, the structural adjustment programs were being stopped, that their meetings were now going to be open to the media and to the general public, that they were going to be meeting with affected communities and citizens around the world, then we would have declared victory and closed down the 50 years is enough office. But that hasn't happened, so the struggle continues.
What does it mean when they say they're cutting the meeting from around a week to 2 days? What actually gets cut?
Well, as the Washington Post noted on Saturday, a lot of the events that happen over 2 weeks are events that are about wining and dining and cheese receptions for corporations and businesses. The actual meetings of the institutions, there are two committee meetings. They usually happen on the Saturday and Sunday, or Sunday and Monday, which is why on April 16th and on previous years, the Sunday meeting is the one that has been targeted. And then they have 3 days usually of official meetings. That's when you see the, you know, heads of state, like, you know, in 1999 when President Clinton addressed the meetings here in Washington. The actual official meetings are 3 days. The rest of them are series of seminars that cost anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000. Corporations and businesses and consultants and other people who are looking to benefit from the largest of these institutions participate in.
What about the preparations of the D.C. mayor and police for the anticipated protests, September 29th and 30th?
It's completely outrageous. They are talking about, the original report was that they were asking the federal government for $50 million. Now that the meetings have been scaled back from 6 days to 2 days, apparently they're asking for $35 million. They met yesterday with the White House, and the White House seems to be willing to support this request for funding. But in a city that, you know, has very few public services left, you know, the parking meters here are privatized, the money goes to Lockheed Martin. DC General, the hospital that catered for 80,000 uninsured citizens of DC, is being privatized. All kinds of services are being cut because there's no money available to provide for the residents of Washington, DC. But the city government and the police department is going to a great deal looking for money to basically repress activists and militarize the city of Washington, D.C. And this for two institutions that do not pay a single penny in taxes to the District of Columbia.
We're talking to Jokey Jehu. She is the director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign. Well, it's beyond 50 years that the World Bank and the IMF were established, Jokey.
Yes, we believe, we have maintained that our campaign, when it was launched in 1994, was kind of a line in the sand, saying that we had enough of the policies, the economic and development model that these institutions have pushed, and that line continues to stand because they haven't changed very much. The rhetoric has changed, the gestures have changed, but the fundamental content of these institutions' policies haven't changed. So we maintain our position that it is enough.
I want to bring Sylvia Federici into this discussion with Jokey Jehu. Sylvia Federici is a professor at Hofstra University, and she was in Parma, Italy, when the Genoa protests were taking place. And then there were secondary protests in Parma and Rome and a number of other places. And I wanted to talk with the two of you about what you feel are the successes or the strengths of the protests and the weaknesses. Sylvia Federici, were you surprised to hear from Italy that the protests in Genoa led to the shortening of the World Bank IMF meetings here?
No, I was not surprised at all, because, in fact, in the days following the Genoa demonstrations, immediately the government, the Berlusconi government, announced that they would try to move two upcoming meetings, one by NATO that is going to be held in Naples, in fact, on around September 26th, and the other one, a meeting by FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization, which is a UN agency, that is going to be held in Rome in November. And there has been now a storm of criticism, discussion, debates in Italy around this proposal. In fact, particularly because Berlusconi wanted to move the FAO meeting to Africa and suggested Kenya, in fact.
Why?
Well, it's very interesting. I think there is a number of reasons. There's really a number of reasons. I guess, first of all, there is the illusion that if they bring it to Africa, there's not going to be protest there. I think there's a tremendous ignorance on the side of the Italian government, and they don't realize that, in fact, much of the protest against the IMF, the first and most massive protest, I'd say, against the IMF and World Bank, were in Africa itself, were in places like Nigeria, like Ghana, Zambia, because these were the regions that felt first and most forcefully the impact of structural adjustment program, which have had a totally devastating impact on the life of people at every level. So but there's probably the illusion that, in fact, by removing it from Europe, either the protest will be less challenging, or it will be more hidden from the media, and that, you know, government, African government, can repress it with more impunity.
I want to ask Jokey. Jokey, aren't you from Kenya?
Yes, I am.
What is your response to the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi saying that these meetings should be moved to Kenya?
Well, I mean, I think there's a tacit, nod to governments that it is okay to repress and to torture and to mistreat activists, and in particular anti-corporate globalization activists. It's not an accident that they would suggest Kenya, because they know what the government there has done to protesters in the past. Even on April 16, 2000, a few days before the A16 protest here in Washington, D.C., despite the fact that the Kenyan government supports the calls for debt cancellation, they arrested 62 people who were making those calls and marching on the World Bank office in Nairobi in April of 2000. So it is, that request by any government saying, let's move, we fear protests, let's move it to Kenya, or let's move it to another country, let's move it to Singapore or Qatar for that matter, is an acknowledgement that there are governments which are going to repress and which are going to put all kinds of violate people's human rights, and they do that with the consent of the international community. The government of Italy should be ashamed to even suggest that, because they are actually declaring open season on activists, not just in Kenya, but around the world.
Silvia Federici, you have long looked at the Italian colonial legacy in Africa. Can you talk about that for people outside of your country to understand where Berlusconi is coming from?
Colonial relations has a long history, but has a history also that is more recent. For instance, I want to remain with Kenya. If anybody who travels today along the coast of Kenya, particularly in places such as Malindi, I suggest a visit to Malindi to get a very graphic first impact with Italian colonialism in Africa today. Because Malindi, for instance, is a place which has been bought up. People have been expropriated of their land, clearly with the collusion of the Kenyan government or Kenyan local authorities, in order to construct a village, a tourist village. Not only a tourist village, actually a village where Italians can retire. You go to the street and you see the sign in the shop saying, come retire, buy land, buy a bungalow, buy an apartment here in Malindi. The street sign are in Italian, the supermarket sign are in Italian. You actually feel you're walking into a completely colonial village. And I've spoken with people when I was there. I went there just to see, because African friend told me I had to. And Africans told me that even the last few jobs, the ones they could do, now they've been taken away from them. So that situation is definitely not unique. Clearly, with the collusion of the local authorities. I find the same ways in other places, for example, Nigeria, where when I was there, I discovered, for instance, that Italian firms were involved in projects that had been the cause of massacres in the north of the country. Just a couple of years before I'd gone, a famous case is that of Bacalori, in Sokoto State, where, for example, an Italian firm was involved in an irrigation process project that led to the expulsion of at least 40 villages, led to the expropriation of 40 villagers, and to 3 days of massacres against these villagers, who obviously resisted, you know, being deprived of their land.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to this very important discussion and also talk about the latest news of another protester being found dead, protester in Genoa. We're talking to Sylvia Federici. She is a professor at Hofstra University in Long Island, professor of coordinator of the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa. And on the telephone with us from Washington, D.C. is Jokey Jehu, who's director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign. In our last segment today, we're going to look at a conference that has gotten very little attention, but could be as or more significant than the UN Conference Against Racism that's taking place in Durban. And it deals with the issue of racism, particularly in the United States. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The fallout from state violence at last month's G8 meeting in Genoa continues. Another Genoa protester has been found dead. While it's not clear that her death was related to the protest, she's a well-known labor activist in Padua and was at the G8 protests. Her body was found on a riverbank with a broken neck near Padua. And Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi said last week that his government is considering moving the UN World Food Summit scheduled for Rome in November to an African location, saying African countries support the idea because they want to be closely involved in issues that affect them. The Prime Minister's stance has provoked indignation among opposition politicians, critics saying the Italian state is abdicating its responsibility to ensure a forum for lawful protest and undermining other governments' determination to stand firm against extremists. The suggestion should also prompt criticism that Italy is trying to export violence to Africa and raises the legacy of Italy's colonial history and the continent. We're talking to Sylvia Federici of Hofstra University and coordinator of the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa, and Jokey Jehu of the 50 Years is Enough campaign in Washington, D.C. On this issue of the NATO summit possibly being moved, what's the significance of that, Professor Federici?
I think it's very significant because within the context of Genoa and within the context of the repression, and particularly the discussion that is going to be expected at this NATO meeting, which is the discussion of the missile defense shield. Remember, so far, the Italian government is the only government who has given a sort of unconditional support, enthusiastic support to the idea. So they can very well expect, in fact, it's already been announced that there will be a strong demonstration. The mobilization is going on as of now. So they are very much concerned, and they would like to move it. Particularly since in Naples, there is the mayor in Naples, Iervolino, who is a woman of the center-left coalition. She has refused. She refuses to militarize Naples in the same ways that Genoa was militarized. She has said she's not going to shut down Genoa. And so the debate is going on, but I don't think it's going to be moved, because now there is a sentiment even within the government coalition, the government right-wing coalition, that Italy would lose its pride, its national pride. In a sense, Italy has to show the world that they can keep order. So that, but it shows that it's very, very important. I think that these people have to understand that now, you know, few leaders that are shaping the destiny of the world, they claim the right to shape the destiny of the world, cannot any longer meet as they have done in the past unchallenged. That, you know, people are beginning to mobilize, expose, denounce, refuse to accept that this concentration of power and this abuse of power. Why should eight white men decide the destiny of the world? Very interestingly, they did not suggest to move the G8 to Africa because the contradiction, the fact that these eight white people are deciding for people in Africa, people in Asia, people in Latin America and so forth, would have stood out, you know, too clearly. But this is what is happening. The fact that now people are challenging that and they are beginning to feel that impact, I think, is extremely significant and important.
I want to go to the issue of media, first to Jokey Jehu and then back to Silvia Federici, talking about how it went in Italy. One of the major issues raised around your prime minister becoming prime minister is that he now, being a major owner of the media, owns the entire national media in Italy, both the public and the private media, and how that affected the protests in Genoa, being a part of those meetings. But first, Jokey, you were not at the Genoa protests, were you?
No, I was not. I was actually in Kenya participating in a regional seminar involved in working with people in nine Eastern African regional countries who are working to build capacity and build a strong network on economic justice issues and debt in particular.
Well, I wanted to ask, and also you were central to the protests, the A16 protests last year, the World Bank protests on April 16th. How you deal with the media, the age-old issue that unless there is violence or property destruction, the media doesn't cover it. And then when they do, they deal mainly with the property discussion and the destruction. I was here during the Genoa protest. There was almost on the Sunday talk shows, almost no mention of them, except to say that Bono refused to go because he felt they would be violent. Jokey, you work with the media. How do you frame the discussion so that they're dealing with the issues?
Well, it's a very difficult challenge and one that, you know, we've tried all kinds of different things. You know, for September this year, we are working in kind of a media collaborative that includes Jobs with Justice, 50 Years, Essential Action, and Institute for Policy Studies and the Center for Economic and Policy Research to really try and focus and get the media to talk about the issues. It's a real challenge, and for me, one of the things that I keep doing is challenging the media to really cover the issues. When they talk about violence and they talk about, for instance, the buildup and militarization here in Washington, to point to the fact that this is being done with reference to what happened in April 2004, A16. Well, the fact of the matter is that of all the hundreds of people who were arrested, not a single one was convicted, despite the attempts by the prosecutors here to make those charges stick. So it's okay to talk about, they can talk about the possibility of violence, but not to do it in a way that implies or that does not actually refer to the fact that what they are using as an excuse is something that did not actually happen. The reality versus the hype are two different things. And to come back to the issues back and again and again, when they talk about that they think there's going to be violence and that they need this money, to say, well, how come they haven't rallied those kinds of resources so that DC General will not be privatized? To talk about the fact that these institutions are not good corporate citizens of the District of Columbia. They don't pay taxes. If they care so much, you know, the bank and the fund issued a statement saying they were concerned about the city of Washington. It's rhetoric. It's like their rhetoric around poverty reduction. If they care so much, they should be contributing by contributing to the tax base here in Washington. It's a real challenge, and a challenge that I keep putting on the heads of journalists to really cover the issues and not to do the easy story, you know, of just looking and making generalizations, but to really talk about who are the people who are involved in this, how long have they been involved, what are the issues behind it. It's a real challenge and one that we keep pushing every single day.
I wanted to get reaction. A senior official at the International Monetary Fund declared this week that the fund is not obligated to promote human rights around the world, responding to accusations that the institution has shown indifference to such principles. Grant Taplin, assistant director of the IMF's Geneva office, also said before the UN Subcommission for the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights that the IMF is not bound by various human rights declarations and conventions. Government officials from poorer countries denounced the announcement, saying the IMF, as well as the World Bank and WTO, lack international accountability due to the fact they're not subject to international law. What about that issue of not being bound by international law, Jokey?
It's actually a huge contradiction, because the World Bank and the IMF, as they like to say, their shareholders are governments of the world, which have, you know, under the UN, have come up with the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on the Child, the Rights of the Child, Convention to End Discrimination Against Women. So if the same governments are sitting in New York at the General Assembly, are also members of these institutions, the rules that they make in New York at the UN General Assembly should apply at all times and in all places for all projects. In fact, this is what we have maintained, that the World Bank and the IMF should recognize and respect, defend and protect internationally recognized human rights instruments and human rights positions. They are not exempt. Absolutely not exempt. And this is why when then they start talking about, you know, other things, how they care about the poor, how they care about growth and development, then they can't make that statement on one hand, say they don't care about human rights, and then expect us to take them at their word when they say that they care about development and they care about the poor. They should be bound, like every government, every institution should be bound by this international recognized human rights instruments. The World Bank and the IMF should be no exception.
I want to go to a kind of case study. Sylvia Federici, you have co-edited a book, A Thousand Flowers, Social Struggles Against Structural Adjustment in African Universities. Your chapter, The Recolonization of African Education. Can you talk specifically about the student movements? You lived in Nigeria for years.
Yes.
And what is happening to the African university?
Basically, what happened in starting when 1984, was that as part of the package, structural adjustment, IMF package, which the World Bank and the IMF were basically imposing on Africa, most African countries, in the name of solving the debt crisis, which was supposed to be a package that was guaranteeing the recovery of African economy. None of that has happened. In fact, things are far, far worse than ever were before. But as part of that packet, one of the conditionality was a major, major cut in social benefits, from healthcare to education. In the case of education, that meant that basically the government had to withdraw completely any public funding of secondary and tertiary education. The World Bank claimed that this was to boost, to shift funds towards elementary education, but actually it did not materialize, and this was not the case. Rather, what was the case was that for in the mind of the World Bank, I think this is very important, you know, Africans were the destined to a particular type of work in the International Division of Labor, basically destined to do manual work, farming. In fact, at one point, a World Bank officer said that. He said, Africans don't need universities. You know, you just need some secondary training, some vocational training, and that's that. By the way, this was the policy of Leopoldom of Belgium, you know, in the Congo. And so they basically cut, university have cut pretty much everything. funding to buildings, to keep maintenance buildings, to libraries, to get books, to cut students' allowances for food, for the transport, again, for books. Remember that many students in the last decades have begun to come from a poor family. The African students, as privileged, you know, as they may be, we compare to the many who don't have access to education, many of them come from poor families who could never, they could never go to school, and particularly to a university, unless they had a subsidy. That has been cut. Teacher salary has been frozen. Basically, with the university teacher salary, now you support the family for a week. Particularly because, in addition to the wage freeze, you also have massive, massive devaluation. So the African campuses have turned into battlefields. And this is where we have begun to do this work, recording the struggle, recording, criticizing, analyzing the significance of this World Bank plan for education.
How organized are the movements?
The movement is very well organized. In the book we have... of course, you have to remember, first of all, that this movement now is at least 20 years old. And it's a movement that at first seems just to respond to the immediate situation. But when you begin to look at over a 20 years period, and when you begin to look at the nature of the demand, the perspective of the struggles, you begin to see that what African students are fighting now is a new independence struggle. That what we have in Africa now is a movement that has the same significance as the student movement had in the struggle for African independence. It's really a movement about self-determination. You destroy the educational system in a country, you destroy the future of the new generation, you destroy the future of the youth. Regardless of what was the content of that education, African students were in the process of battling, discussing, redefining the education they wanted to have. Comes the World Bank, that is over. The university itself is becoming a wasteland. And the students now, many of them have been forced out. They now come to the United States, they try to emigrate. In Brooklyn, if you go to a car wash, you will find many graduates from African universities. I understand that if you go to Greensboro, in the chicken poultry of North Carolina, you're going to find many graduate students or aspiring students from Niger and other countries.
I want to end with you, Jokey Jehu, on the issue of the globalization protests. Because on the one hand, you have Silvia Federici describing what's going on in Africa, this new independence movement led by African students. And on the other, you have the globalization protests from Genoa to the World Bank protests. Protests here is largely white, something very different, of course, than on the African campuses. You yourself are from Kenya. You're leading the protests here. Do you see it changing? And what do you think is the key for the integration of these movements?
Well, I think that one of the issues that keeps a lot of people of color out of these movements is the culture of the mobilizations and the collective that exist, because of the ways in which these collectives work, these coalitions work, not just people of color, but more experienced elders, if you will, of the movement activists are not able to participate in these movements. And there is a great deal of work that needs to be done by activists in countries like the United States to look at the ways in which they exclude, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the ways in which they exclude people of color, the ways in which they exclude elder activists, the ways in which they exclude people who are of low economic social status, poor people, and others, because it is as well as gay, lesbian, and transgendered people, because of the culture that exists. A lot of the coalitions are very cliquish. They have schedules where people meet in the evenings. The meetings are in the evenings. If you have a child and childcare concerns, if you have young children, it's not very possible for people to participate unless you bring your child with you, or you have other arrangements that you can make. But when you look at the number of organizations, if you look at 50 years is enough just to give an example, of the five people working in our office, myself, a colleague who is a Haitian American, a work study student who is from Nigeria, and a high school student who is Korean American, that there are lots of people of color involved, but for whatever reason, they are not able to participate except on, you know, sort of on the outcasts or outskirts of these mobilizations. There's a lot of work to be done around anti-oppression, anti-sexism, anti-racism work to be done by those of us who are involved in mobilizing to make this a movement that is broad and diverse and that includes rather than excludes, which happens to be sort of the way in which we most of these coalitions are functioning. And people, you know, citing pressures of limited time to organize and all of that are quite resistant to dealing with these issues, I must say, as a self-criticism of the movement. And it's something that we have to deal with. Otherwise, it's really all lip service and we are not much better than the institutions that we are targeting and saying that they don't listen to ordinary people and the people affected by their policies.
We only have 20 seconds, but Sylvia Federici.
I think what Njoki is saying is very, very important. And I would add to like to add another dimension, which is it's very important that people realize that these days, these days of action, like what is going to happen around the World Bank or what happened in Genoa and so on, you know, they are not the places in which all is decided, but they are part of a long struggle. They come from afar. They come from places like Africa, from African villages and towns and so on, and therefore the issues and that struggle have very deep roots. I think it's very important, both because the question of the power relations within the anti-globalization movement must also be talked about on an international level. And second of all, because there's too much of the tendency to put all the stakes into these particular days and not realize that all over the world, people are struggling now against globalization.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Contact information, Njoki Jehu, 50 Years is Enough, where can people go on the web?
www.50years50years.org or call our office at 202 IMF Bank, 202-463-2265.
And 1,000 Flowers, Social Struggles Against Structural Adjustment in African Universities, co-edited by Sylvia Federici, is published by Africa World Press in Trenton, New Jersey. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. There's also a booklet that has just been put out on the issue of that the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa put out called State Violence and Structural Adjustment in African Universities. And if people want to get a hold of that, where can they call?
They can write, we have either to my address.
Give a phone number.
The phone number would be 718-622-2240.
I want to thank you all for being with us. When we come back, we're going to take a look at a conference that has been taking place in Geneva, just finished up, and what it has to do with the Conference on Racism and with the United States. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman, and if you got to hear that little interlude of music, it's Warrior Trilogy, and that is Lightfoot from the CD Tribal Boogie, and we hope to be joined by this Native American rapper later in the week. Well, With all the controversy surrounding the upcoming UN conference against racism in Durban, South Africa, another UN meeting on racism has gone virtually ignored in the United States. This morning in Geneva, the UN released its report on the U.S. compliance with the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The committee noted with concern the incidents of police violence and brutality, including cases of deaths, which affected minority groups and foreigners in particular. The group also said there was also a disturbing correlation between race and the imposition of the death penalty. Unlike many other international treaties, the U.S. actually signed and ratified this treaty. That means if the U.S. is found to be non-compliant, the U.N. can require the United States to change its laws. Leading human rights groups, civil rights, and constitutional rights groups from the U.S. recently traveled to Geneva to testify on the state of U.S. compliance with the convention. Nancy Cheng has just returned. She's with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and was in Geneva for the preparatory meetings around the convention. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. We'll start off by explaining the significance of this meeting and how it relates to the Durban conference that a lot more people are focusing on.
Right. Well, Amy, this is this was a historic hearing at the United Nations in Geneva that was held on August 3rd and 6th. The Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Race Discrimination was actually adopted by the General Assembly of the UN in 1965. It took the United States until 1994, nearly 30 years later, to ratify it and enter it into force. And although the first U.S. report was due 1 year later, it took the U.S. 5 years to produce its first report. This was the first opportunity of the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Race Discrimination to review the U.S. report, present questions, and hear the United States out, and as of yesterday, issue recommendations.
And the findings.
Exactly.
But what they found in yesterday's report, talking about the correlation between racism and the death penalty, et cetera.
Exactly. We have the press release from the United Nations. We have not yet been able to get from our friends in Geneva a copy of the actual recommendations and report. But we see that the committee has focused on the legacy of race, state-sponsored racism in our country. We see that they acknowledge that because of our policies of slavery, acceptance of segregation, and policies toward Native Americans and the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Japanese internment camps and so forth, they understand that the United States has lingering effects of racism that permeate every aspect of American life. And one of the key problems that came up in the U.S. report was the refusal of the United States to agree to eliminate racism when it rears its head in the form of disparate impact, racially discriminatory results, which appear at least appear to have a race-neutral basis.
Like the death penalty?
Exactly. And this became one of the large, one of the major sources of criticism of the U.S. report.
We're also joined on the telephone by Tim Cooper, who is Executive Director of Democracy First and a representative of the World Organization Against Torture, USA. He coordinated the NGO effort in Geneva. Can you talk about the role of the NGOs in a covenant like this?
Oh, well, good morning, Amy. I'm happy to be on your show.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. This is a new venue for U.S. NGOs to, or new tool rather, for them to elevate the issues that are of most concern to them, particularly in the area of racial discrimination. Heretofore, U.S. NGOs have concentrated primarily on domestic lobbying and the creation of new law and so forth to affect domestic policy, but before the UN and specifically the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, were able to bring to bear the moral forces of international law to elevate our issues and to press the U.S. government to advance those issues in a significant and serious way. So we are now entering, I believe, a new era where the integration of international law into domestic law will serve our purposes. And I think in many respects, and with particular regard to this treaty, there are higher standards of international law than can be found at the domestic level. And I think that Nancy alluded to that when she talked about the issue of the effect of a policy rather than the intent of a policy. Under U.S. law, you have to prove intention to discriminate, whereas under international law, you just have to show that there is the effect of discrimination. And that's I think, the essential difference between the Race Convention and U.S. Jurisprudence at this point.
And what relation does this convention have to the upcoming Durban Conference? Does it have any effect on it?
No, it really doesn't. It is coincidental that the hearings were held at a time when preparations were being made for Durban, and I think it was timely and helped elevate the NGO community's consciousness about using this convention as a domestic tool to advance policies against racial discrimination. But essentially, they're separate and apart. And the committee will continue to meet twice a year. U.S. NGOs will be back before the committee in a number of years, and this will go on, whereas the event in Durban will be a one-time event.
Nancy Chang, you do a lot of specific work in the United States through the Center for Constitutional Rights, dealing with violations of rights. Again, people might be listening to this program saying they're talking about all these large UN treaties. I mean, what real effect do these have on our lives and the kind of work that you do as a grassroots activist and lawyer?
Well, that was the frustrating part about this event. We have a constitutional system where our key provisions, the Equal Protection Clause, which requires equality in matters of race, and the Fourth Amendment, have failed to put an end to race discrimination. In the case of the Equal Protection Clause, 25 years ago, the Supreme Court held that proof of intent to discriminate is required. Disparate impact is not enough. In the case of the Fourth Amendment, our Supreme Court has held that the Fourth Amendment allows vast discretion to law enforcement in making decisions on whether to stop, frisk, search, question, arrest individuals. And as a result of this discretion, racism and race discrimination is allowed to permeate our criminal justice system. We see it in the end product, where we have 2 million people in prison, of whom 46% are African Americans, in a population where only 12% is African American. We see it at the stop and frisk stage, at the very outset of contact with the criminal justice system, where surveys on highways show that overwhelming numbers of individuals stopped and frisked are Black and Latino. And of course, this is directly attributable to our war on drugs and our training that our federal government has provided to our state and local authorities under Operation Pipeline.
Tim Cooper, something like 32 out of the 38 countries that have gone through this review process have been ordered to change their laws as a result. Now, what does that mean? I mean, in the United States, there's a huge conservative backlash against, you know, and also not just conservative. I mean, the protests against the World Trade Organization included a lot of people who said we can't have these supranational organizations, you know, larger than countries, determining our laws. And here you have that very thing.
Well, I think you have to separate out WTO. That's a very different issue than a committee that has jurisdiction under an international treaty that the U.S. government has in fact signed on to and ratified through constitutional processes, and that treaty then becomes incorporated into U.S. law. That's a distinction that's important to make. As to backlash, look, this question was raised at a press conference in Geneva. Are we bashing the United States government? And I think my response was simply this, that we are simply asking the U.S. government to live up to its international legal obligations that it solemnly swore that it would undertake to carry out. And we are simply asking the U.S. government to live up to the letter of this convention. And I'm not at all certain as to why that should create any kind of backlash whatsoever. It's simply a matter of law. And we're simply here to say the U.S. is obligated to uphold these international standards.
So where do you go from here, Nancy Cheng, as you come back to the United States? Are you going to go to the Durban conference?
I'm not able to go, but I think that we need to... We see from the press release that the committee was very critical of the U.S. in a number of respects, and we need to follow up on this. They've specifically mentioned that our criminal justice system is definitely has a race-based character to it. They've commented on the death penalty and sought a moratorium. We have to pick up from where they've the recommendations they've left off and push in the United States for a true elimination of all forms of race discrimination.
Final words, Tim Cooper.
I think it's especially important is that the U.S. government must ensure application of these standards at all levels of government, not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. And this was the way that the U.S. government framed its argument by saying, well, we really can't affect what goes on at the state or local level. We can only kind of focus in on the federal concerns. But the committee is saying, no, under international standards, you need to ensure application at all levels of government. And that's a very important statement on the part of the committee.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Nancy Cheng, if people want to get in touch with you at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where can they call?
Area code 212-614-6420.
And Tim Cooper, if people want to get involved in these activities, what would you say is the next one or what people can hook into right now as Executive Director of Democracy First and Representative of the World Organization Against Torture, USA?
Well, the World Organization Against Torture does a great deal on U.S. compliance with various international agreements, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So that'll be one of our next projects. We can be reached at 202-783-8046.
I want to thank you both for being with us. And before we outro the whole program, we thought we'd end where we began, and that is with Michael Franti. We started with Rock the Nation, and now we go back to our roots, and that is listener-supported.
Live and direct, we come and never be recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Ha ha.
Michael,
don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never...
Michael Franti and... listener supported. And speaking of listener supported, we want to thank the brain trust of our producers, Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro, Errol Maitland, our spiritual technical director. And I've been instructed to acknowledge those who make Democracy Now! Possible. Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports Pacifica Radio. And we'd like to thank the Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, as well as the Pacifica affiliates. We are all Pacifica. We'd also like to thank John Alpert and the folks at DCTV, that's Downtown Community Television in New York, who've generously allowed us to broadcast from the historic firehouse on the edge of Chinatown. And special thanks to Chase and Andy. Yes, reporting from the studios in exile. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Banned and the Fired, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.